Shabbat shalom. Impressive as Budapest's Dohany Street Synagogue is, and it is, the most significant thing about it is not what you see, but what you don't see. Last week, I returned from our synagogue trip to Prague and Budapest with about 45 congregants planned by my dear colleague, Rabbi Charles Savinor, and lay chairs Vicky Warner and Eileen Penn. Aside from the thrill of watching the Cubs win the World Series at 5 a.m. in the Prague airport, the most awe-inspiring moment of the whole trip was taking in the breathtaking view of the largest synagogue in Europe, the second largest in the world, the interior stunning, the exterior breathtaking, the Haftorah I chanted there, a YouTube sensation. With seating for 3,000 and additional 2,000 standing, the sheer size of the Dohany towers over our modest little shtiebel here on the Upper East Side. And yet, as our group stood there taking in this immense Oriental Byzantine architectural feat, my thoughts turned to what we couldn't see, what used to be there at Dohany Street number 2, the two-story classicist-style house, the home in which Theodor Herzl, the founder of political Zionism, was born and raised. The home of Herzl's birth and the Dohany Synagogue on the same Budapest block. It's an image worth pausing to reflect on. Consecrated in 1859, if nothing else, the Dohany Synagogue is big. It exudes a self-confident Jewish community, both affluent and self-assured, secure in their relationship with their neighbors, their government, and most of all, a grand assertion that roots are being put down, a Jewish community that is here and here to stay. All of which makes it so jarring to consider that just 1 year later, in 1860, young Theodor Herzl would arrive into this world at that very same spot. More than any other figure of modern Jewish history, it was Herzl who understood the precarious, vulnerable, and fleeting nature of Jewish life in the diaspora. Herzl, who as a correspondent for a Viennese paper, witnessed the trumped-up charges of treason against a French army captain, Alfred Dreyfus, a man brought down by institutional and popular anti-Semitism. Herzl, who reasoned that the only place that Jews could be both fully Jewish and full citizens of the world would be in a state of their own. I imagine Herzl going back to his hometown in the late 1890s as his Zionist leadership took hold, perhaps bringing the kids to see their grandparents and looking up at the Dohany next to which he grew up and saying to himself, "We Jews are fooling ourselves. How very naive this monumental delusion of a building. What we really should be doing is building a state." Now, neither in 1859 nor 1899 could anyone have imagined the horrors that awaited Europe's Jews, how prophetic Herzl's concerns would be. In Hungary alone, 600,000 Jews murdered. The Dohany, the architectural jewel of Jewish Europe, reduced to a stable for the Nazis. In the intervening years, the synagogue has been restored, but the juxtaposition of the two, the lingering question, remains. Our group stood there reflecting on the world that once was, the confidence that must have been theirs, the narrative with which they comforted themselves, and then, of course, the horror that would become. A European Jewry navigating between permanence and impermanence, vibrancy and vulnerability, a story that we discovered is still playing out today. It would be impossible for me to share with you all that we saw and did in our packed week together. There are many trip participants in shul today. They're actually wearing stickers, and I encourage you to ask them questions, each one of us affected differently by what we experienced. But for me, it was a question that I pondered on the Dohani street, power and powerlessness, past, present, and future, that framed our time together. I asked a question or a form of it wherever we went. We began the trip in the Czech Republic, Prague, a city with a continuous Jewish presence for some 1,000 years. Prague is a city that gave life to the luminaries of our people, from the 16th century philosopher and mathematician David Ganz, to great philanthropists like Mordechai Mazel, to perhaps one of the most significant thought leaders of our people, Rabbi Judah Loew, better known as the Maharal of Prague. Not just his knowledge of our tradition, but for his ability to integrate the emerging scientific picture of the universe into his pre-Enlightenment thinking. The Maharal was a rabbi both intellectually and personally engaged with the world around him. He had an audience and reported friendship with the Emperor Rudolf II. And yet, despite his stature, were you to ask anyone what the Maharal is best known for, they would share with you the legend of the golem, the Frankenstein-esque creation that he's said to have set in motion in order to save the Jews again and again in their hour of need. The point is not whether the golem was a legend created by the Maharal or by later generations. The point is that the golem is a projection of all of the anxieties of a diaspora Jewish community not altogether secure in their surroundings. The tensions we saw were not just those of physical security, nor particular to just the 16th century. We visited the home of Franz Kafka, interestingly a chronological contemporary of Herzl's. Kafka is perhaps a paradigmatic example of a Jew giving expression to his unsure place in the world, alienated from his surroundings and from himself, going to sleep in one skin and waking up in another. To go to Prague is to witness the ongoing efforts of Jews to come to terms with the disorienting perplexities and insecurities of their Jewish selves in a non-Jewish world. And today, there are only a few thousand Jews left in Prague. It's more like a Jewish museum than anything else. But a visit to Prague is to come face to face with a world that once was. When we visited the concentration camp of Theresienstadt, the site of nearly 150,000 Jews being killed or sent to their death, we left with a sense of the music, the theater, the scholarship, the poetry, and the art that was Czech Jewry, a community that from Maharal to Kafka and everyone in between had so much to offer the world, but never would, and now, save for a few struggling communities, is no longer. I, for one, will never again enter this sanctuary in the same way, knowing that on display we have a Czech Torah retrieved from a destroyed Czech community. It's unfit for use. It's a symbol for what once was, a culture and community that not even the golem itself could have saved from the hands of the Nazis. And as we went from Prague to Budapest, our questions about Jewish past, present, and future grew more, not less textured. While anti-Jewish laws were on the books beginning in 1938, the bottom did not fall out from Hungarian Jewry until very late in the war, spring of 44, when the German occupation began. Over the course of the next 2 months, over 400,000 Jews were deported to Auschwitz to be murdered, an effort that could not have been accomplished without the willing collaboration of the Hungarians themselves, their devotion to the final solution surprising even Eichmann himself. Of all the memorials we saw, and we saw many, it was that of 60 pairs of rusted shoes on the promenade of the Danube, a testament to the 10 to 15,000 civilians, mostly Jews, who were lined up and shot into the river by the pro-German anti-Semitic Arrow Cross Party. The story of Hungarian Jewry in the Shoah is one that must be understood in its fullness, be it the collaboration of the local populace, the heroism of Hungarian-born Kana Senesh, or the quiet and sometimes controversial attempts of Jew and Gentile to save Jewish lives by people like Karl Lutz, Roel Wallenberg, and Rudolf Kastner. To study the Hungarian chapter of the Holocaust is to encounter a vivid admixture of hope, defiance, heroism, and inescapable tragedy. But what we discovered in Hungary was that the questions we were asking were not situated only in the past, but very much in the present and the future. The rise of a far-right party in Hungary making for a problematic present. On the one hand, I felt totally safe walking the streets wearing a yarmulke, far safer than I do in other European cities. Hungary's anti-immigrant policies give it a calm that I've not seen elsewhere in Europe. And yet we discovered the Jewish community is understandably concerned with the rise of a fascist politic. The monuments we saw memorializing the victims of the German occupation, all of Hungary framed as a victim, ignoring both the fact of Hungarian collaboration, not to mention that the Shoah was a calamity inflicted specifically on the Jewish people. It's not just the loss of democracy in Hungary that's worrisome, or the dishonoring of Jewish lives. At stake is a question of the safety and security of a present-day community of some 100,000 Budapest Jews who themselves are seeking to understand, no different than those who came before, just how safe and secure they really are. Do they stay or do they go? Our return to the States the day before the election has only further stirred our concerns as all of us realize the emergence of a populist rhetoric of hate that's not limited to one side of the Atlantic. None of us, it would seem, are immune to the inconvenient truth that we are living through a time of dramatic change in our world political climate. And yet, even with all these concerns, we saw wonderful pockets of hope. One evening, we visited the Balint House, a JDC-funded JCC of Budapest. We saw young children learning to read Hebrew, teenagers taking Krav Maga, Israeli martial arts, and we sang and we danced with Holocaust survivors. We had dinner with counselors of the Sarvash camp, an intensive 10-day summer experience, also funded by the JDC, that's reinvigorating Jewish life and living in Central and Eastern European Europe. We joined the Neolog Synagogue for their Friday night services, and were overjoyed by the hospitality, vitality, and charismatic leadership of their rabbi and rabbitson. Hungarian Jewry is not what it once was, not even close. Like Isaac following the Akedah, they are descending from the mountaintop, forever diminished by the Shoah, struggling to build after decades of communist rule. They are nevertheless energetic, scrappy, actively working to chart out a future, and altogether deserving of our support. Wherever their path should lead, I look forward to finding ways our community can partner with them in the years ahead, all the more so should the political landscape turn dark once again. Grand as the Dohani was, hospitable as our Friday night community may have been, for me, it was a brief mincha afternoon service that our group prayed at Theresienstadt that I will not soon forget. Despite being incarcerated in the hell of the Theresien ghetto, the courage was found to turn a tiny storeroom into a secret prayer space. It was too small for our whole group to fit in, but we prayed outside, all of us left to imagine the quality of the faith of the petitioners who must have been given expression in those narrow halls. The passage of time and the effect of the elements have not been kind to the room, but one could still make out the Hebrew letters etched onto the walls. One wall asking God to deliver Israel from distress, another calling on God to have mercy, the third a reminder not to forget Jerusalem, and the final, V'techazena enenu b'shuchah l'tzion, pleading to God to return to Zion. The setting, a secret prayer space used by Jews prior to their death, was, if nothing else, a monument to the tragedy of the diaspora. Their prayers beseeching God's return to Zion answered too late to change their horrible fate. The powerlessness, the vulnerability, the fate of a European Jewry who could build the Dohani and in the decades to follow be reduced to building secret prayer closets. As with any educational experience, we came home with more questions than answers, not just about the past, but about our present and future. Questions we must ask as a congregation, as a Jewish people, questions we must work to find answers, thus ensuring a vital future for European Jewry and for us all. Shabbat Shalom.